One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Janne Schaffer, one of Sweden's most successful musicians, an incredible guitarist, played on countless ABBA tracks. This interview highlights his contribution to ABBA and to music.
It showed that Sweden also can do very good pop music. I don't remember celebrating after Brighton. I just remember celebrating after the one in Sweden, actually. It was just in the beginning we tried many different things, and after a while he made up his decision how to play. Björn and Ben had different ideas how the song was going to be, and then we, as a musician, we were sitting down and waiting for who will win. When we did the recordings, it was a very happy feeling, and he said, you know, we are very inspired by a European group that we like very much. Aha, which one is that? They're called ABBA. Oh, but I'm the guitar player on ABBA. Oh, you are? Oh, ABBA, that's fantastic. That's why we call ourselves Toto, T-O-T-O. Everybody will remember that. Music changes, life changes, new ideas is coming, but I think ABBA will always exist.
Don't go away. Janne will be here in a second. Just time for me to ask you to please subscribe. It helps me and it allows you to hear when I've posted a new interview on this website. Okay, here it is. A real inside story of how it was to work with ABBA with Janne Schaffer. So I'm going to make a Swedish meatball of your name, of course, but Janne Schaffer. I don't know if that's right. Sounds like a very Germanic version of Swedish words.
In Sweden, they say Schaffer.
Schaffer, Janne Schaffer.
Schaffer or Schaffer is the same, yeah.
Okay, now we got it. That's perfect. In this series of interviews that I've been doing, the first question, because I know you've had an amazing career on your own, but because this is connected to ABBA as well, the first question that I've been asking people is, where were they 50 years ago on April the 6th, 1974?
I was playing in Stockholm at a place called Puttes, together with Björn Jason Lind and a couple of guys and called Hörselmat. And usually we had a group, me and Björn Jason Lind, and the drummer was Ola Bronkert, but he was in Brighton at that very moment. And so we had another drummer, I don't remember who, but I played there, and I remember very well, they had a TV in the audience somewhere, and I rushed up and see how did it go for ABBA, and then suddenly they won, and it's very happy, yeah.
Oh, amazing. I'm amazed that you actually didn't follow the whole show, but I'm going to get back to that later because I really want to talk about you and your life.
I must add also, I wasn't there with my body, but my guitar was on the backing track. You know, all the they had two of the competitors were allowed to use backing tracks, and ABBA was one of them. And so my guitar, Ola's drums, Rutger Gunnarsson bass, and Benny's piano was on the basic track, but they were singing live and everything else was live recorded.
That must have been an incredible night for you too, because of your involvement in them. But as I said, I'm going to come to that later, but I want to start really with you. And you were brought up in a post-war Sweden, where post-war the world was changing. The world of the adults was becoming the world of the teenagers slowly. So I wondered, first of all, what music you learnt or you heard in your childhood, and when that first changed into hearing popular music.
You know, I grew up with two parents who met at the Swedish Academy of School, Music Academy of School. And they were, my mother was a piano teacher, and my father played the violin. And I grew up with classical music, fantastic music. My father was playing in the chamber orchestra in Stockholm, and I really enjoyed it. My mother was a fantastic piano player, but she was teaching in our home, so I never learned how to play piano because I had all the pupils coming in to play the same thing over and over and over again. So piano wasn't my thing. But the first impression of music that I really turned me on was Elvis Presley, Heartbreak Hotel. That was the first one.
What was so special about that trigger? Because if I think, you know, I'm slightly later era, I'm not much younger than you. But for me, you know, the early 70s were when I was a teenager, and Bowie was a trigger for me because he provided a world where I felt I could belong and not in the world of my parents. So was Elvis, in a similar sense, also provided a different world, the world of a young kid, of a teenager who could express themselves differently?
Yeah, it was another sort of music, you know. I was, the first time I heard Elvis, I said, oh, can music sound like this? This is fantastic. I was very much attached to that, to his vocals, and it was fantastic. And that was 1957, 1956. I was in school and I built an acoustic guitar on my own in the school, actually. And I started to play, and I immediately noticed that was my instrument. And then, at that time, but it was not, the music was Kingston Trio, a little bit about that. But the first thing after Elvis that really touched me was Cliff Richard and the Shadows. That was, and I like Hank B. Morin's way of playing was fantastic. He had a special sound, and that really moved me.
I mean, that must have been a very exciting period to be brought up in, because it is sort of, you know, the first rock and roll movement and the first era of the teenager. I think I would have sensed that it was sort of a sense of belonging for all people of that age. Was it an exciting era also in Sweden?
Yeah, it was. But the music was, my parents didn't like it at all. You know, they tried to make me avoid that kind of music, but I, they didn't succeed very luckily. So I'm in that generation who actually the next thing that really moved me very, very much was a tune called Please Please Me with the Beatles. I said, this is fantastic. I heard it on the radio, but in the Swedish radio you could hardly listen to pop music at that time. So I had to listen to Radio Luxembourg very much to get in touch with that kind of music.
Yeah, it seems like it was an interesting period. I've been reading about the development of music in Sweden post-war. and about, now I'm going to get this wrong again, Folkshut Park, the FP, who would provide places where Swedish artists could cover international artists. And this was another sort of sense of growth within the country of becoming more into music that was more international. So how important was it, do you think, the social development in Sweden alongside the musical development at that period?
I immediately got very involved in music because I love music, playing so much. I met some guys and we formed band together, and I was still studying in the high school, and but I tried to play at the same time. And sometimes we played at the folk parks, but we were also like playing in clubs in Stockholm. There's a very famous place called Nalen, which still exists. And there was a lot of pop bands, Swedish group playing in the 60s. And I was, after a while, I went around all the American and English group who came here. I went to their concerts and listened to them. I went and saw Mothers of Invention with Frank Zappa. When he came into the concert hall, he said, "You don't understand one note, one meaning of my lyrics, so I do the whole concert instrumental." And he did that. I heard The Doors with Jim Morrison. I heard Janis Joplin. I heard The Band, which was a fantastic band. I heard The Beatles in Johannes Hov. It's a big place in Stockholm, and they were fantastic. I also heard The Rolling Stones with Brian Jones, but that wasn't the biggest musical feature I heard. But I saw them a couple of years ago, and now it sounds fantastic. But at that time, I wasn't too much keen on the Rolling Stones. I played with a small band called Sleepstones, and we had a supporting band who borrowed our instruments, and that was Pink Floyd with Sid Barrett.
So tell me about how they played your instruments, and also what did you learn from them then?
From Pink Floyd.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if that was a sort of close connection at that point, I'm sure there was sort of a transfer of information.
Yeah, that concert didn't. I wasn't that impressed from that concert, and when I listen to it today, they were not really sober, so to speak. And I think when Dave Gilmour came into the orchestra, it became quite another thing than it. But I heard Pink Floyd then later on with Dave Gilmour. He's fantastic. The band was so great. But the first time they played here with Sid Barrett was not the best one, I think. I never saw that, but I was very impressed by the British group called the Yardbirds. And I follow Eric Clapton because he was the first guitar player in that band. And when he played with John Mayall and the Blues Breakers, I never saw Clapton with John Mayall, but I saw Mick Taylor with him and Pete Green. And they were fantastic guitar players. So they impressed me very much in the 60s.
So you talked about your early bands. And I just wondered, with your early bands, were you looking really much to the outside for inspiration? Because when I talk to a lot of artists, their initial band, they're often a copy of their heroes rather than creating their own identity. So was it that for you as well, that you were actually like looking, I wouldn't say a direct copy, but, you know, a strong influence from another band instead of actually sort of creating your own identity, which you did later?
I think the whole 60s we were copying English and American bands and tried. We very few bands did their own music. We were just copies of everything. The Swedish music started from in the 70s. Maybe one exception is the Sputniks, a group from Gothenburg, and with the guitarist Bosse Winberg, he was very special. He had a very special guitar sound. He had small hits in the 60s, but what I can remember, that it was the only band who really had something on their own, so to speak. But it, for me, for my own way of thinking, I think the Swedish music started in the 70s.
So tell me about the, you know, you mentioned the clubs in Stockholm that you could play in, and all these artists coming in. What was the community of musicians like at that period? And was it a supportive community where you had a sort of natural exchange with each other, I presume, because it was not that big?
In the end of the 60s, I was playing with Björn Skifs sometimes, the Blue Swede. And because everybody left their band. I mean, I also a band you're familiar with, the Hep Stars. They broke up. Every band broke up in the end of the 60s. And we were going around and looking for something else, something new. So we tried something, small things in here, little here and little there, you know. And I started 1970. I started as a session musician also. Then I had studied in the university in Sweden for 4 years. And I noticed that in the next room, there was a very rather famous guy called Björn Ulvaeus. He was studying the law things. I don't know what he studied. He studied something.
And you were studying economics, I think, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right.
So talking of economics, when did you realize you could make a living out of music?
When I started in 1970 doing sessions, I really got a lot of sessions. And at that time, I thought maybe, I mean, I didn't know what to do, actually, because I knew I don't have any musical education. I just studied a couple of things, economics and other things, just to see what I could do. I didn't know. But the only thing that really the passion was for music, actually.
When you say you didn't have a musical education, I know that obviously you had some form of education from hearing classical music from your parents, but then learning the guitar yourself. Do you think in a way that benefited you not having an education because it gave you the freedom to experiment and find different directions?
I'm not 100% sure of that, I must say. Because after a while, 1972, 1973, I got involved with a very good friend of mine, Björn Jisson Lind. And he had studied in a musical high school for 10 years. And he was on flute, piano, and also he was a composition. And I must say, that guy, Björn Jisson Lind, taught me the most of music. It was fantastic, but he never taught me how to play guitar. he just wrote some pieces and he said, you can figure it out yourself, how you want to play that. And I tried to do it, and we fit very, very well together. And so he taught me small things that I could read music a little bit, not very good, but I knew what to read music, what it was about, how it works, but I never studied it. So quite another thing. I think to be educated as a musician in high school is very important, I think, to learn how to play and to know a little more about the music, how it works. It's so interesting. The whole music scene is so interesting.
I mean, one of the key moments of change for you is when Johnny Nash was touring, because he was in London and he went over to Sweden. So tell me that story and how you got to record with him.
Mm. Yeah, you know, in the... You could say the 70s, there was an explosion of music, trying to get new ideas, new music. And there was a guy who I met who was living in Sweden from Africa. His name was Reebok Kwakiba. And me and two other guys, two very good jazz musicians, Uffe Andersson and Bobo Stensson, we helped him with a solo album. He played at the same time with a group called Traffic. He also was doing some things with the Stones, I heard, percussionist. But he called me up and asked me if I wanted to be on a film score for a Swedish movie. And I asked him, what kind of movie is that? Yeah, he's coming. It's an American soul singer, Johnny Nash. He's coming to Sweden to act in the movie. And he also going to write the score for the film. And so I said, yeah, that sounds nice. And Johnny Nash came with a manager and an arranger and a musician called John Rabbit Bundrick, very good piano player. And then when we started recording with him, we noticed that it was a lot of music, and we suddenly discovered that he made some demos for his forthcoming album. And one day he called me up and said, they were staying at the house not far away from me in Stockholm. He said, could you come to the house? I'm going to show you some new music for my new album. And I listened to a record he played for me, and he said, what do you think about this? And it was little there. And I didn't want, they were so nice. I said, this sounds very interesting, Johnny. And after 2 days, the guy who sang, who was going to teach you the new music, came to Stockholm, and that was Bob Marley. Because wow. Johnny Nash had been on Jamaica and found Bob that he was a very good composer for music. So we actually recorded one of his songs. I think it was Stir It Up. And on drums at that time was Ola Brunket, who later on went on with the recordings with ABBA.
Well, that's amazing. So Bob Marley taught you reggae?
Absolutely. Yeah, he did. We were sitting in the studio and doing, it's a lot. If you listen to the soundtrack from that movie, you can hear so many things that it's really interesting music. And John Rabbit Bundrick, he was a fantastic piano player. We kept in touch for many years. And he went on as a sideman with The Who, for instance. And he also played on Bob Marley's first album, Catch a Fire, which he recorded in London, 1972.
So Bob Marley was actually writing Catch a Fire in Stockholm, wasn't he?
Yeah, he did that in the basement at in the house where he stayed in 1971 in Stockholm. That I heard, yeah.
Could you tell that you were hearing someone who would create history? Because you've been around so many people, you know, and contributed in many ways to their success. So can you actually really identify someone who's got such an immense talent and will be successful? Or is success something else? Is that a bit of luck? Because there are many talented musicians in the world.
I must admit, I didn't realize that he was going to be a very big star 2 years later. That was... it was impossible to notice that. He was very shy. He was very laid back. He didn't say very much. He just taught me, don't push it. Lay back, you know, don't push it in. But he taught me how to play in the studio. And I experienced that very good. And it was a fantastic experience to have playing with him in the studio. But that I just met him in the studio. We were never outside doing gigs or something like that.
Being a session musician was how you got connected. I know you mentioned that Bjorn Alveus was in another room studying another subject, but yeah. How you met them and got to their studio was by being a session musician. So tell me how they contacted you and what happened.
Yeah, you know, Stikkan Andersson has started a Swedish record company called Polar, and I recorded a couple of other artists like Lena Andersson, and also with a big band called Gugge Hedrenius Big Band. And I think actually Benny Andersson was producing that album. But the first
Lena Andersson was the first artist that Benny and Bjorn wrote for that entered the Melodien Festival, I believe. That was the first time they entered with Lena Andersson. So, called you up, and what did they ask you to do?
Yeah, but Lena Andersson's first album wasn't produced by Bjorn and Benny. That was another guy. But they called me up because they were supposed to find young Swedish talents, and they called me up and said, could you come to the office? We have found a young guy. And I went there, and there was a fantastic singer, Ted Gärdestad. He was 15 years old, and he was singing tunes one after another. And Benny asked me, what do you think? I said, this is fantastic music. Okay, do you want to record with him? Yeah, of course. Because that music came to my heart, really, and still do. And so they asked me, do you know a drummer? I said, Ola Brunkert. I played with him a couple of times, and bass player Mike Watson. He came from England, but with the English group, and he stayed, met some girl here, and he stayed in Sweden. And the studio was Metronome, and there was Michael B. Trieto. And then 1971, we started recording Ted Gärdestad's first album, and that was called Wanderings in Swedish, Undringar. And it was released 1972. But before it was released, we all got a phone call from Bjorn or Benny, I don't know which one, saying, we have made a tune of our own. It works so nice in the studio. Do you want to record with us? Oh, absolutely. And that tune was People Need Love. That was the first ABBA tune, so to speak, that we recorded. Ola Brunkert, Mike Watson, me, and together with Michael B. Trieto. And then after that, just went on.
So tell me about that first recording, because how was the collaborative process? Because you've got all these extremely talented people who were to make an immense contribution to what was to become ABBA. And I just wondered how it worked in the studio. Did they have the song formed in any way? What was actually taken into the studio, and what was contributed by the others, including yourself?
You know, it worked at the same way as we worked with Ted Gärdestad, because he had some songs. He knew the melody, he knew the chords, but he asked, for instance, me, do you have some idea of an introduction, a little guitar if you, here and there? And I gave a suggestion. They said, that's good, we take that. So when we came to ABBA, it was the same thing. I think they had the melodies and the chord for during the verse and the refrain, but sometimes they asked, can you do some small guitar lick here or a small introduction here? And nothing was written down. Because the first time when we went into the studio, Benny sat down with the piano and he played the song. This is the tune we're going to play. And we sat down, wrote it down on the paper. And then we started playing around and around and around, trying so many ways to... we tried many, many... It could happen that this could be a country song. Or then we tried country. No, it's not country. We try rock and roll. No. And then we try for many hours. And then they say, this is how it should sound like. And then we'll be back at the first, like we had at the first hour. And you could record for four, five, 6 hours, you know, every song. They were very cautious that it should be very, very good. And we worked our asses off, so to speak. We were really trying to do the absolutely best. And we were one day we we recorded with ABBA. Next day, maybe we recorded with Teddy Adelstad, because they were still producing Teddy Adelstad. They produced Teddy Adelstad's first four albums at the same time as they recorded their own music. So it was a lot of, you know, if you're familiar with the group and the session musicians in Hollywood, like the Wrecking Crew, we were about the same thing. We were the same drummer, the same bass player, and we played together. After a while, there was a new bass player who came in, Rutger Gunnarsson, and I asked him, where do you come from? He said, I'm studying classical guitar in the high school, but I can get no job as a classical guitar player, so I changed to bass instead. So there was, sometimes it was Mike, sometimes it was Rutger Gunnarsson.
While the first album was being recorded, ABBA's first album was being recorded, you were also working on your own first self-titled album. How was it for you to work on what obviously was what your absolute love was, you know, your type of music, and then to work on ABBA in a sort of consecutive way? How did that operate for you?
I was used to play with a lot of people, and as a session musician, I did so many sessions with other artists like Family Four and Lasse Berghagen, and that music was written down. And I also had met Björn Isolin, who was very inventive in his musical thinking. And so when I got the offer to do my own album, I had some small ideas. I'd listened to a group in America called The Meters. And I also, we were more little, sort of, and I also listened to Larry Coryell and I little smaller fusion music. So that what, I recorded my own album is a totally different music. And that's what I liked. and I had no problem with the recording with ABBA and Gerdestad and doing another thing on my own. It's just music in different kind of ways, you know. But when I was recording my first album, I had no intention that this was going to be a commercial success. So I was in touring in Israel with Björn Isolin and the choir, one and a couple of the best jazz musicians in Sweden. And when I came home, I was number one, and that was number one for 6 weeks. And that was a gold album. And I'm very thankful for that. But I was a little bit scared, because I thought, if I'm selling so much, maybe they don't want me to on ABBA record. I told them, I want to go on recording with you, so you don't feel like that. Even if I sell very much, many records, I'm still love to record together with you, because it's different. When you play with many people, you learn so much. And I also learned very much how Björn and Benny was thinking of making a very good tune and the work. So, and working with Teddy Adelstad was also fantastic. In 1973, I was in Sweden, 71, 72, 73, 74, there were live orchestra with a Eurovision Song Contest. And I was there in 1973 when they played Ring Ring, came number three, and that was also Teddy Adelstad at that same time. And then I was 1974, 50 years ago, I was I had both recorded Waterloo with ABBA, and I was also sitting in the live orchestra. It was fantastic.
Tell me about the recording of Waterloo. And because it's one of those tracks where, you know, you mentioned Michael Tretow, who sort of brought that wall of sound into ABBA. And this was really a point where, to me, and maybe I'm wrong, to me, where the ABBA sound was really coming to the fore and being very identifiable. So tell me about the recording initially of that track. There's much more to come with Jana. Don't go away. But for now, please subscribe And as usual, it helps me, but it also allows you to find out when I've posted something new on the channel. Okay, let's get back to the interview with Jana Schaffer.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Yeah, it was, I think we recorded the same way like we did with Ring Ring. And, you know, after a while, when they wanted to get the bigger sound, and Tretow had some idea that when we had found the basic track, this is the take, then we should dub the piano and the guitar. And he changed the speed a little bit on the tape recorder. And we were working very hard with that tune. And the tune is in D major. And we suddenly, I think Bjerner or something, asked, we need some little figure under the refrain, like, on, for instance, on Ring Ring. Benny, I wrote them down, which is a little thing that combines the whole lyrics and the refrain. And he wanted some idea for the Waterloo tune. And then I suggested to tune down the low E string to D. And I had a very simple, I mean, it's very traditional thing, yeah, it's a very simple thing. Yeah, I mean that's good. We try that. So that was Rutger playing bass together with me. That small tune, and then we put on the guitar, and Mike and Tretow. He was pre-mixing so many tracks. There was only 8 tracks tape recorder at that time. So we had to make some pre-mixing to get the sound so they could put all the lyric, all the vocals on, all the harmonies and so on, which I think is fantastic. It's fantastic how they managed to get the whole song together. I was never involved in that mixing. I just heard the fantastic result afterwards.
I mean, I heard that they nearly entered Hasta Mañana into the Melodian Festival that year, which was the pre-festival to Eurovision. Were you there when they changed their decision, and know why?
Well, you know, this is 50 years ago. I mean, some things are falling out of my head, but what I remember was I got a call from Bjorn Orbani, who said, we are choosing between Waterloo or Hasta Mañana. What do you think, Janne? And I immediately said, Waterloo, it must come, pop music must come into the Eurovision Song Contest. So I told them, take Waterloo. So what I heard, they called many people around and asked for their opinion. And so the definite decision was from I don't know. I wasn't present at that time, actually.
What were Agnetha and Anna Frid's roles in the studio?
to be honest, I have no idea, because they may, a couple of times they came in and Benny checked with which key was the best for them to sing in, they have the vocals, and then they left. So we were just working with the background, and I'm so impressed for some of the songs I recorded. I can't have a number that 45, 46 tunes I play on. But every time it was, I'm so curious to see what the final result will be for this backing track. Because you didn't know how the vocals were supposed to be or the harmonies on it. But I'm so impressed. For instance, SOS and Mamma Mia. Because I think from Mamma Mia and SOS, the real ABBA sound went on. And I think maybe Waterloo was the first actual real ABBA music. Because I think ABBA's, the identity of ABBA is the music of their own. You can immediately hear, this is ABBA, this is Benny playing his music. And so it doesn't sound like anything else. It's not funky, not American, not English. It's a Swedish kind of Swedish music, Swedish pop music, which was, I'm so proud to have been involved in that little small pieces with their big success, actually.
You said that you learned from Benny and Björn in the studio, how they worked and how they thought. Can you tell me exactly what that was and how you took that and transferred it into your own music, their way of thinking?
I can't say I took it along to my instrumental records, but I formed a group 1980 together with a Swedish artist called Lasse Åberg, and we formed something called Electric Banana Band. And at that time, I know how to do music with vocals. And I think to never give up, to try and find something that really works. It takes some time to do that. It's not the first take, but to never give up, and to be concentrated to play as good music as you really can, and not make it the short, easiest way, and maybe try so many things to get it really, really right.
What do you think they got from you, apart from obviously your guitar playing and everything, but what do you think they actually gleaned from you that may have helped them in their way of thinking?
I really don't know. I just to play as good as possible and give away some ideas on some small things and have patience, because it took many hours, and it also was when we did the recordings, it was a very happy feeling. And sometimes when we work for many hours, Michael Betrieto put on Charles the Transmitter in English, Kalesendare in Swedish, and he was a guy who was very funny, and everybody laughed, and then after that we were happy again and could get the happy feeling. And I don't know. After a while, when Benny, I realized Benny knew had much more control over how his music was supposed to play. So, in the 75, 76, 77, was like, I was mostly more and more doing overdubs, and he told me exactly how to play. So there was just in the beginning we tried many different things, and after a while he had made his decision, he made up his decision how to play, how the music should be played.
If you're enjoying this interview with Jana Schaffer, there are many more interviews related to ABBA. I've put a whole list of them below with the links, so please check them out. Okay, back to Jana.
You know, I never toured with ABBA because 1974, I was touring in the States with an American singer called Sean Phillips for 2 months. And when I came back, my son was 1 year old. And but ABBA asked me to do some promotion tour in the States 2 weeks later after when I came back. And I said, that's impossible. But I will still record with you. But you have to take another guitar player. When I can't make it, you can take it. And they took Lasse Welander, who is an extremely good guitar player. He was fantastic. Very sadly, he died last year. And we were making a contribution album with his music now. We're going to release it actually on the same day as on the 15th, on the 6th of April. And I also heard it was 1 year ago at that date he died actually. So it will be very nice to honor him. And I'll play one of his songs, solo, as a guitar player.
When you talk about working together and there was some sort of communal friendly atmosphere, And what I find really fascinating is that, you know, you've had a child, you've gone on tour, you played 47 gigs, I think it was, with Sean Phillips in the States. You come back and your child's 1 year old and obviously you want to spend time with your child. And so you turn down going back to the States with ABBA. Yet they wanted you to come back. So there is very much a camaraderie between everyone who was involved. Was it really like that, or were there ever, I mean, there were obviously going to be disagreements about how things are done, but were there any real disagreements, or was it always a process which you were able to get through and make some sort of decision?
The only thing I can remember is sometimes they had different ideas. Björn and Ben had different ideas how the song was going to be. And then we, as a musician, we're sitting down and waiting for who will win, which way are we going to record? So
who won the most?
I think Benny did. But I mean, mostly it was Ulvaeus sitting in the control room as a producer, and he had such top feeling for when you play a song over and over again, you have to have the feeling this is the take. And he was extremely good to notice this is the take. Because I felt the same way. When you're playing, sometimes you say, no, this is not, so the drums doesn't, I mean, we hear something, but when he said this is the take, even if there's some slight mistakes in the wrong notes or something like that, he was almost always right, I thought. And when, I mean, we recorded with Teddy Edestad around the same time, so we had a big experience. We knew each other very well, musical-wise, both personal and musical-wise. But we were not hanging around in the bar or something like that. We were just meeting in the studio. That was the only. When we met, we sat down and took our time. It was no stress at all. We just play together and to get the right feeling and to have a very good... We had a good time, actually. That's the easiest way to express it.
When your third album came out, Catharsis, it got very good reviews in America, I believe.
Mm.
And so how was that for you? So there you are in... one band who are becoming massively successful, and then with your own music, the jazz fusion music, you're all getting credible success and you're getting reviewed favorably by Rolling Stone.
Yeah, I was very happy because then I decided to have my own career together with Björn and Lin. We played together, we had a group together. I I was very close to get connected to Björn Nilsson Lind. I must say more to Björn Nilsson Lind than to ABBA actually, but because I just recorded with ABBA in the studio. But I mean, since I never did anything live, I was very close to Björn Nilsson Lind, and that was fantastic to get that review, which also led to that I could record in Hollywood 1977 together with the guys who at that year formed the group Toto. Jeff Porcaro, Mike Porcaro, Steve Porcaro, and therefore Joe Porcaro. And Björn is playing on that album as well. I'm very proud of that.
So tell me about Emil and how the Porcaros got involved and what actually happened in the recording of that album.
You know, there was two managers from CBS coming to Stockholm and saw one of the concerts I did with Björn Nilsson Lind, and that was Don Ellis was one of them. The other one was Paul Atkinson, who actually was the original guitar player in the Zombies, and he went on to be a manager on CBS after that. And so they asked me if I wanted to record in Hollywood. Yes, I said, yeah, fantastic. And they asked me, who do you want to play with you? I said, Björn Nilsson Lind is the most important one. And then I had a friend who I met in Stockholm, piano keyboard player Peter Robinson, who came from Brand X. And he also played around with Phil Collins. He was in his band, but he lived in Hollywood. So I said, Peter Robinson would be nice. And then he said, "What the drummer?" And I said, I listened to a record from an American guitar player who played with all my brothers called Les Dudek. And on that record is a fantastic drummer called Jeff Porcaro. Oh, then you have very good taste, because he's the hottest drummer in Hollywood, in the Hollywood scene. Okay, yeah. And when I came over, we had no bass player, so I asked, yeah, do you know bass player? Hey, you can use my brother, Mike, and percussionist. You can use my father, you. And so we recorded, and after a while, Steve Porcaro also was playing on one of the tracks. And during that period, Jeff Porcaro said to Björn Nilsson Lind and me, come to the studio, we just form a band, and you must listen to what we did. I'm so proud of this, okay? So we went to the studio, and he played the backing track without any vocals on, and it was Hold the Line. And he said, you know, we are very inspired by a European group that we like very much. Aha, which one is that? They're called ABBA. Oh, but I'm the guitar player on ABBA. Oh, you are? Oh, you know, a band with just four letters and two are the same. It's fantastic. So everybody remembers that. So ABBA, that's fantastic. That's why we call ourselves Toto, T-O-T-O. Everybody will remember that. That's what he told me.
Oh, what an amazing story. You played, you know, you mentioned, I think you said 46, but I've heard from Carl Magnus Palm that it's 50 tracks of ABBA, but you played an enormous amount of tracks from ABBA and made a significant contribution. Out of all the tracks that you played on, what do you feel for you is the track that you feel you had the most contribution and you feel is the best track?
I like many tracks, actually. So, I mean, Waterloo was a very special one, but I like one, If It Wasn't for the Night, because there's a lot of guitar overdubs on that one. And I also like As Good As New, which I play on a Fender Telecaster. And I also like very much, it's mostly because Rutger Gunnarsson plays fantastic bass on a tune called My Mama Said. And I have a small guitar solo at that one. I think it's the only one that is a real guitar solo. And I also like one tune, both me and Lasse Wilander, we are playing on the same track. I don't know how many times we did that, but one track I like very much is Eagle, which I always play on my concerts. I think that's a very beautiful track.
So into the 80s, you'd formed the Electric Banana Band.
Yes.
And you'd moved away, let's say, from ABBA to do your, you know, to do really your own thing. I mean, you'd been doing it all along, but now you were doing it away from ABBA, as it were. So you must have been aware of the end in that period, the end of ABBA, and also the period that ABBA seemed to be very out. And I just wondered how you saw that period.
I was so much involved with other things. I mean, I worked both on my own stuff, and I met Lasse Åberg, and I made some film score for his movies. But I must mention one more thing I did during that period in the 70s, that I recorded with Agneta, her solo album. And at that time, Björn Isolin was also involved in her album. And I also played on a couple of tracks of Frida's solo album at that time, when ABBA still existed. But after, when ABBA in the 80s, I started working with, I would done that, because 1979, I helped Teddy Gärdestad produce a record, because he won the Swedish Eurovision Song Contest 1979. And I was arranging that song. And I also arranged a song when he was in the Eurovision 1980. And I played a couple of tunes with him a couple of albums with him in the 80s as well, as along with the Electric Banana Band and my own. We started together with Björn Isolin, we started recording with Symphony Orchestra. And so I did a lot of other things, you know. And then 1992, I met Teddy Gärdestad again, and he had gone through some mental problem, and I helped him produce his last album, 1994. And it was very special. And so I did a lot of other things, you know. So I was so much involved, because ABBA was immensely big outside Sweden, but not maybe. I mean, it was so much other things happening around me in Sweden. So I was involved. I didn't give so much attention to what ABBA did or not did, you know, at that time.
I think what's really fascinating, I mean, your career has been so full, and I mean, you've been honored. You've got, I'm going to say the award, Literis et Artibus, which is one of the highest, or the highest probably, award in Sweden for contribution to music. What does it mean to you to be honored in that way when you've had such a long contribution to Swedish and international music?
I'm very honored, and I'm still very, I'm very thankful that I still am alive, and I still can go around playing with the people. Now I'm doing my own concerts called My Music Story, and play a lot of my own music, and play one ABBA song in that act, and that's Eagle. I play that. I play a lot of Teddy Gärdestad, because he's not living any longer. He died 1997, so I'm mostly happy that I still go around, and I don't know really what to say, but I want to play as much as possible, because I still have the passion for music, and I think it's very important to give away what you experience with music. I know I've seen so many it helps so many people to get through heavy stuff when people die and so on. You have a memory, and I play on funerals and also weddings sometimes.
I mean, I interviewed Martin Gerke from the band Grunelund, and you worked with him. So your contribution to young musicians is also really fascinating. So what did you think of that band, and what was your contribution to them?
It's fantastic, because I think Martin is a fantastic composer, and he arranged, he's written all the music, yes, is all written down. And I knew that he likes ABBA very much, and I said, this is not the way we recorded ABBA, because we had nothing written down. we played in the studio, so it's a different way, but I think he's immensely talented. He makes very good music, and I like him very much. I think it's a good band, Grunelund.
And also, what's interesting, I mean, you told me about that you were number 5 with Many Few in the dance chart in the UK. You're actually number 4. Oh. you know, they play at the Ministry of Sound and so on and so forth. How fascinating is it for you to be involved in different genres of music, and what do you get out of that?
It gives me so much experience. It gives me experience of life. I mean, to meet young musicians like Many Few, who makes fantastic house music, and the way of the making the music is rather similar to my way of thinking music-wise. And I also have a group with some actors in Sweden called Night Agent, and the music is a little bit like Depeche Mode, and that's also very interesting. And I also played a lot with some jazz musicians, and I played with the Swedish radio jazz group, and I met Palle Mikkelborg, a Danish trumpet player, who's fantastic. And to meet, play with young cats, and that they want me to play with them, I feel very honored, actually.
Okay, we started this interview talking about the Eurovision Song Contest in 1974, and on that evening, you were playing a gig, turned on the TV at some point, found out that ABBA had won. What was the first meeting again with the group and the other people that had gone to Brighton? And how did you celebrate?
I don't remember celebrating after Brighton. I just remember celebrating after the one in Sweden, actually. After that, in Sweden, Stikkan Andersson was very happy. Come to my home, Janne. Yeah, we were having a party at his house in Djurgården. After the Brighton success, I can't remember that there was some celebration. Maybe they probably had it in Brighton, but I wasn't involved, so I was just happy for them that they won, and ABBA's music had meant so much to Swedish music, to new young cats, Max Martin, Avicii, Europe, Roxette, you mean, name it, because it showed that Sweden also can do very good pop music, and I think it's what I'm so proud to have some small fingers in their playing. So that's what I think about ABBA.
Well, I think it's amazing. I mean, you've had an amazing career with your own jazz fusion music and the different styles that you've been involved with over the years. And of course, as you say, with ABBA, who opened the doors for almost all other Swedish artists after them, to show that you can be successful internationally. And I think it's amazing that your contribution to ABBA lives on today, and probably will live on forever. So Jana Schaffer, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart, because it's been brilliant talking to you and fantastic to sort of find out and hear some of the stories of the past. I want to end on two things. Your beer. You have your own beer.
Yeah. I have.
How did that come about?
You know, when Björn Jonsson Lind died, we tried to make a scholarship to honor him. So we did three contribution concerts, and we got some money, but not too much. We were trying to give scholarship to young musicians to think about the future, the Swedish music in the future. But suddenly there came some from God, I think, in form of mail to my home side that which said, "Hi, Janne, we are some young cats interested in music, brewing beer in Umeå. We want to brew a beer called Janne Shuffle. Can we do that?" And I called them up and I said, "Yeah, on two conditions. One is that Lasse Åberg made it the etiquette of it, and my royalty goes immediately to the Björn Jonsson Lind this scholarship." So we have gotten. I'm not earning one krona from that, but all money that I was supposed to get is going to young musicians, and we're going to develop that in December for the tenth time. So it's I'm very happy and proud to be able to do that.
What a wonderful thing to do! The last question: Eurovision is coming up. What will you be doing on that night? Will you be playing somewhere, or will you be watching it?
I might be watching it, actually. I don't now competing for Sweden or to Norwegian guys. I like that song very much. I think I hope for the best for them and hope they get lucky and win or do something. Eurovision Song Contest today is not, sorry to say, the same thing as for 50 years ago. It's quite another thing. And but music changes, life changes, new ideas is coming. But I think ABBA will always exist. That's what I think.
Well, I got to end there. ABBA will always exist. Jana Schaffer, thank you so much. It's been brilliant talking to you. And keep going. Keep inspiring the younger generation and keep making music, I would say.
Thank you. Thank you for letting me speak to you. It was very, very nice. I've seen you so many times on MTV, so I'm very honored.
Up there is an interview I recommend. Down there is where you can find all the podcast interviews. And here is where you can connect.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.